Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is The Big Picture and this is A.B. Dawji. I like that intro. Very, there are lots of snap, crackle and pop. Well, here we are on the last lap. Can someone tell me where 2018 went? Now, in just over a week, Johannesburg will be empty and Durban will be chock-a-block with BMW four-wheel drives and Range Rovers and Toyota Land Cruisers. Why do they need 4x4s there in Joburg, eh? Joburg is so flat. And then they will come here and complain, hey, man, Durban is so hot and humid. Sure, unbearable. And then they will be guzzling big tumblers full of mineral. No. I really like them, eh? All these Joburgers. I can't wait to meet them with warm words of welcome. Hey, when y'all came, when y'all going and all. And now to the light and breezy stuff. The crazy stories that made it into the headlines. Actually, this story is neither light nor breezy. In fact, it stinks. It's quite sickening. Came 1994, we saw the dawn of a new South Africa. Everything will change, everything will come up roses. People who were downtrodden in the past and oppressed, people who suffered discrimination in terms of everything, education, housing, job opportunities, everything, were now going to be uplifted out of the cesspit, the sewage pit, to have dignity and a good life. What a load of sheer nonsense. I remember seeing a picture of the cafeteria at Parliament during its first session in 1994 in this new democracy. Salesmen from Mercedes-Benz company were busy signing up deals with our bright new Democrats, the new MPs. And since then, it's been downhill all the way. Almost every day I open the papers and there is a new report of looting on an industrial scale. The bright new South Africa is in the darkness of load shedding because of a combination of mismanagement and looting. SABC? PRASA? That's the rail service. What about SAA? Top boys have been getting their greedy, grubby fingers into the money we entrusted them with, your hard-earned money and the taxes you pay. They're supposed to be servants of the people, helping the citizens, but they have been helping themselves. The VBS looters. Well, corruption is endemic. It's a cancer. And can be, well, you know, cancer can be fatal. We read about millions being stolen. Sometimes we hear of billions. It doesn't shock us anymore. It's like, well, it's like normal. 100 billion disappeared, 100 million in irregular expenditure. That's what we are told. Irregular expenditure. What irregular expenditure? It means Chorwan action. That's what it is. Estina Dairy Project to help the poor. Estina Dairy Project to help the poor. To help the poor millionaire rogues. So why am I cross? Well, I'll tell you. I said previously that it's a great shock to hear that a child at school fell into a pit toilet and died. How many proper toilets could have been built with the money wasted on so-called the security upgrade at Inkandla? Dear listeners, pit toilets are really the pits, meaning you can't get worse than that. You can't get worse than that. Wrong. Yes, you can. What made me cross was this article this week. Listen, pupils at Mundundu Junior Primary School in the Eastern Cape borrow a broken toilet seat from a staff member, from a staff toilet, to put over holes, which are all that is left of most of their school toilets. 18 of the 20 pit toilets for the 202 pupils are broken. 10 of these are just holes. Staff have two toilets, one for men and one for women, One is broken and the seat can be removed. Teachers say students often take their toilet seat and put it on the holes. They say female teachers have to hunt for the toilet seat before they use the toilet. The school in Gatiane, Ndundu village near Butterworth was built in 1985. School principal Buyani Biketsha said two of the 10 prefab classrooms were destroyed by wind 8 years ago and they have not been replaced. None of the classrooms have window panes. Some have broken doors. The roof leaks. When it is windy or raining, pupils take blankets to school. Biketsha said since the school has only 6 teachers, grade 4 and 5, grade 4 and 5 share a classroom and a teacher. Grade 7 and 8 also share a teacher and a classroom. One classroom, for grade 7 and 8. Ash. Biketsha said when he arrived in Ndundu in 1992, the condition of the school was not good, but it was better than it is now. He said repeated approaches to the Eastern Cape Department of Education to fix the school buildings have been unsuccessful. Biketsha said, we sent so many letters to the department asking them to build us a new school with no luck. And it says here, Biketsha said, they were told there was no budget to rebuild the school. We were told to wait at least 4 years for another prefab. They said the department is still busy fixing mud schools and our school must wait for the 2022-23 budget. No budget. No budget. Well, just take 10% of the salary of some of the useless members of parliament and you can build the toilets. How much money was wasted on Malusi Gigaba over the years so that he could wear fancy suits and open the gates to his Gupta friends? He knew how to handle things. He knew how to handle things in more ways than one. I won't expand on that joke. Well, I suppose expand is the operative word. No budget to build toilets for kids. No money, eh? Listen to this news from just 2 days ago. Lucky Montana. He used the 2010 World Cup to justify a closed tender for gates. Now, you know that you get these gates at railway stations where if you've been overseas, you would have probably encountered them where you buy a ticket and then you go to an automatic gate. You stick your ticket in and the gates open, the turnstiles open. Something like when you are leaving a car park, you know, a closed car park. You put your ticket in and the gates open. Well, Lucky Montana was in charge of PRASA, which is the rail service. Well, there was a tender that was won by Siangena Group. And the public protector at that time was Tuli Madonsela, and she notes that in 2009, PRASA advertised a tender for the installation of high-speed access gate at Doornfontein and Nazareth stations. Siangena put in a bid of 1.1 billion rands and got the job. They got the job. This was despite its another competitor for the bid, Protea Coin, having come in at just 700 million. So Protea put the bid, 700 million, but Siangena won the contract at 1.1 billion. And then it was extended, improperly extended, so that they could put up gates at 7 other stations, including Cape Town, where the high-speed gates still do not work. So 8 years ago, this was put up, and those gates are not working. And so they got they extended this contract illegally. The contract was extended, as it's alleged in this article, and so from 1.1 billion. They got a further 800 million. And this was supposed to be at the time of the 2010 World Cup. He said, no, we need it because lots of people are coming from overseas, everywhere. So we need these special gates to get the people through. But the gates were only put after the World Cup in November. Can you believe it? The gates were put after the World Cup in November of that year. 4 months after the final World Cup match had been played. Now, I don't know. These are all the allegations in this article. And it points to great Chorwan action on a grand scale. Shah. So there you are. Total 1.9 billion spent on 54 gates that don't work. The gates don't work. Did you get that? 1.9 billion total paid out. How many toilets can you build with that? But instead, that money went down the toilet, wasted. Makes me so cross. Kids have to borrow a broken toilet seat from the teacher to put on a hole in the ground. That, my dear friends, is a crime against children. Yes, it's a crime. The big shot politicians should be made to use this broken toilet seat just for one day. Just for one day. Where is the humanity in this new South Africa? Where are the human rights we were promised? Where are the very basic human rights for the kids at school? Makes me sick, I tell you. And while almost every day we hear shocking new cases of corruption, I rarely hear of anyone ending up in tronk. Some of the Chorwans are still in parliament. And when someone is caught not doing, or if they're caught out doing unsavory things and are fired, then they run to the courts to keep their jobs. They are like this, they are like Teflon politicians. Just can't leave. Remember Claudi Motsoeneng of the SABC and Tom Moyane of SARS running to the courts. There should be tough action. And I'm not suggesting that we should do what China does. If you are a corrupt politician or public official, you face a firing squad. No ifs and buts. Short and sweet. Nor am I suggesting that we should have such tough laws as they have in Japan. And I'm changing the subject a little bit. It says here, let me read this to you. It says here, a 64-year-old Japanese man has been fined more than £1,300. How much? £1,300 for stealing a roll of toilet paper. The man, who has not been named, was found guilty of stealing the toilet paper from the restroom of a hospital in Okishima, an island in Shimane off the west coast of Japan. The man was arrested and charged before he was reportedly fined £1,379, which is 200,000 yen. And I calculated that it is 23,186 rands. 23,186 rands for stealing the toilet paper, which was valued, the value of that one toilet paper was 21 pence, British pence, which is 30 yen, which is 3 rand 75 cents for that toilet roll. The man's penalty for his toilet paper theft prompted huge debate among media outlets and blogs in Japan, with many surprised at the apparent severity of the fine. Several people also pointed out that the man could have bought more than 6,000 rolls of toilet paper with the amount he now faced paying out in fines. The incident also prompted some new blogs to point out to an online Japanese survey 2 years ago, which found that 8.7% of participants had apparently taken home toilet paper from public restrooms in the past. I wonder how many toilet papers have stolen from hospitals and public places like that, blankets and pillows and so on. Oh, I don't want to go into that. The new South Africa. So there you are. Steal a toilet roll and get a fine of, what was it? 23,186 rand. So if we have to equate that, to stealing a dairy farm or a bank, the VBS bank, how much should you be fined? For a toilet roll, he got fined 23,000 rands. If you steal a whole farm, Estina Farm or VBS Bank, how much should you be fined? Well, in the new South Africa, my dear friends, the answer is zero. And you can still remain in parliament. You know, sometimes I think our country is a joke. Okay, let's move on to more serious stuff. Nelson Mandela died on the 5th of December 2013. That day was commemorated around the country this week, where tributes were paid to this great man. On the same day, there was a funeral service for the 41st President of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush, always referred to as Bush Senior, Big Bush, not to be confused with his son, the small Bush, often referred to as the Shrub or Bush Junior. George Bush Sr. was President of the United States from 1989 to 1993. Let me say this very loudly and clearly. Are you listening? I, A.B. Dowji, owe a great depth of gratitude to George Bush Sr. Yes, you've heard me correctly. George Bush Sr. was a great inspiration to me, for which I am very thankful. He inspired me. He motivated me to do big things. That's right. He added richness to my life, changed its direction completely, added a huge measure of fulfillment, created a new awareness of life in me, in life and in the world. George Herbert Walker Bush, I cannot thank you enough for changing my life forever. So, dear listeners, many of you are wondering what I've been smoking. Yes? Huh? Okay, so let me explain. Right up to the end of the 1980s, I went through life with some awareness, a little bit of awareness about what's happening in the rest of the world. Actually, to be honest, very little. I had, of course, a pretty good awareness of local politics and wrote some articles here and there about the huge change taking place in the country, the talks in Lusaka, the talk that filled the air that Nelson Mandela was going to be released, and so on. But as I said, not much about what's happening outside of the country. And then George Bush Sr. came along, and George Bush wanted to attack Iraq. So I wondered what this was all about. Being, well, the word is nadan about international politics, I was a bit curious and began to look into it. And what a shock I got! I discovered that George Bush Sr. was planning to attack Iraq based on absolute lies and a very evil agenda. The more I dug deeper, the more I discovered that this was a huge setup, a plan, a potential crime on a huge scale. And so, dear listeners, I was all fired up, highly motivated. And then I started the Iraq Action Committee, began speaking on radio, many radio stations, and did many press interviews. I said, "Hey, people, wake up. It's all a lie. George Bush is lying." And so, dear listeners, this was a time of awakening for me. I woke up to what's happening in Iraq, what's going to happen in Iraq, and I woke up from then onwards to what's happening in Palestine and Kashmir and many other places, but more especially to the role, the interference of the United States in the affairs of other countries. It was a shocking revelation that George Bush Sr. was a war criminal. And this week at his funeral ceremony, there was a front row bench of war criminals. Donald Trump, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter. Yes, all war criminals. But hang on, it's not just these guys who were seated there. The famous American scholar and social commentator, Professor Noam Chomsky, says that if we had to judge by the description of what is a war crime set down after the Nuremberg trials of the Nazis after the Second World War, if we judge by those standards, then all U.S. presidents since Harry Truman in the 1940s up to today can be classified as war criminals, all of them. And yet, they are all regarded with great respect. Why? Because they have the power. The United States, a superpower, it controls what happens in the world, controls countries. The United Nations, of course, is a toothless tiger. And the U.S. controls how it is viewed in the world. It makes me want to vomit when I saw Bill Clinton here in South Africa as a keynote speaker at a Nelson Mandela Memorial Lecture. What a travesty. What a travesty. Let me just give you just one of his crimes. In August, no, I'll hold on till after the ad break. Right, welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture, and as you can hear, I am very, very cross. I was speaking about war criminal Bill Clinton, who gave the keynote speech at the Nelson Mandela Memorial event not long ago. War criminal. In August 1998, things were getting very hot for Bill Clinton. And by that I don't mean his encounter with Monica Lewinsky at the White House. That happened a few months before. But things were hot because he lied about his dalliance encounter with Monica, and the U.S. Congress was going to impeach him for lying, going to boot him out. Well, it's not this crime that I am concerned about, that he was greatly attracted to Monica. Some may say that he was really, really blown away by her. No, it's not that. It's something a great deal worse. In order to divert attention away from his problems, his impeachment hearings and so on, he did something quite despicable. A clear war crime. Now, the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical factory in Khartoum, Sudan, was the largest manufacturer of medicines in all of Sudan, producing over half of the country's pharmaceutical products and specializing in anti-malaria drugs. But on the night of August the 20th, 1998, Clinton ordered the firing of 14 cruise missiles into the plant, reducing it to nothing but broken concrete and iron bars, leaving thousands of brown bottles of veterinary and other medicines littered across the sand. 14 years later, its wreckage still remains. And it's a shrine to an incident which the locals still refer to as a terrorist attack. The Al-Shifa plant had been taken out on the direct orders of Bill Clinton. It was bombed on his orders. When it was pointed out to the Clinton administration that they had just eliminated one of Sudan's major medical suppliers, the spokesperson for the White House said, claimed the plant was actually a disguised chemical weapons factory. All of this turned out to be false. Soil samples taken by independent investigators showed that there were no signs of the VX chemical that the U.S. claimed that the factory produced. The bombing took place at night, so a security guard was killed, but because of the bombing, thousands more died because of the lack of medicines. The factory's owners sued in U.S. federal court in an attempt to receive compensation for the destruction, but the court dismissed their lawsuit, reasoning that, in their words, the enemy target of military force has no right to compensation for the destruction of property designated by the president as enemy war-making property. What do you think of that? Did you get that, eh? If you translate the last few words, it means that if the president does something, then it is justified. Finish and clap. So Bill Clinton came here as a respected elder statesman. No war crime charges. The U.S. decides who is a criminal and who is not. And just as Clinton is praised, so was George Bush Sr. this week. His crimes are airbrushed out completely, whitewashed. Here's an extract from the sharp-tongued, very sharp-tongued, Mehdi Hassan's article. Mehdi Hassan says, the tributes to former President George H.W. Bush, who died on Friday, age 94, have been pouring in from all sides of the political spectrum. He was a man of the highest character, said the eldest son and fellow former president George W. Bush. He loved America and served with character, class and integrity, tweeted the former U.S. attorney and resistant icon Preet Bharara. According to another former president, Barack Obama, Bush's life was a testament to the notion that public service is a noble, joyous calling, and he did tremendous good along the journey. And the Apple company boss, Tim Cook, said, "We have lost a great American." Makes me want to vomit. Well, there you are, folks. High praise to make you want to vomit. George Bush Sr. was a war criminal for his attack on Iraq. Let me run through the story very quickly. Very, very quickly. Now, I've spoken about this many times before. Here's the short version. Well, Iran booted out a U.S. ally, the Shah, and, of course, by booting him out and taking control of the oil and gas fields and so on, Iran was going to be very powerful, and therefore the United States viewed it as a danger, as a danger. So they told Saddam Hussein, in order to stop the spread of Iran's influence, they told Saddam Hussein, who was a great friend of the West, and in particular the United States, that he should start a dispute with Iran, which he did. And there was what we know now as an 8 years war between the two countries. 8 years war in which more than a million people perished on both sides. And of course Donald Trump was there in the height of this war, and we know that America supplied Saddam Hussein with chemical weapons. 1 million died. Then, after the war, after the 8 years, well, Saddam wanted to fix his economy, and he wanted the oil prices to be raised, and so he told Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, who were selling oil at a very low price, please raise your price. But they refused. Now, it's July 1990. The U.S. ambassador to Iraq, April Gillespie, went to visit Saddam Hussein. She was in Baghdad, of course, she's the U.S. ambassador there. And she visited Saddam Hussein, and she said, "Hey, Mamu, what's your plans?" Over, of course, tea and naan, katai, friendly discussion. She said, "Look, I see from pictures taken by satellite that you've got your troops all along the border between the Saudis and the Kuwaitis, and so what's your plans, eh? What's your plans?" Friendly discussion. And she said, "Well, I'm just trying to frighten them so they can raise the oil price. I'm threatening them." And April Gillespie responded by saying, "Well, you know, whatever you do in respect of Kuwait, we the United States have no interest in the matter whatsoever. We regard it as a local issue, something between you and your neighbor, that's all. We have no interest." Saddam Hussein smiled, he smiled, and he took the bait. April Gillespie had given him the green light to go and invade Kuwait. He smiled, right? And, of course, Kuwait was a part of Iraq a long time ago before the French and the British, that Sykes and Picot, they decided to draw lines in the Middle East and divide the whole place up after the First World War. Anyway, so Saddam Hussein smiled and he said, "Well, I've been given the green light." And a few days later, on the 2nd of August 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And immediately, 2 days later, George Bush Sr. ran to the United Nations and he said, "United Nations must impose sanctions on Iraq," which the United Nations did, the most suffocating sanctions in the history of the United Nations. Suffocating. Iraq had to import everything that it needed. It had the money. It had the second largest oil reserve, so it didn't need to produce anything. And now with these sanctions in place, the whole place was sealed off. Nothing was allowed to enter. And, of course, April Gillespie, the U.S. ambassador, returned to America. And right there in New York, when she was about to enter the hotel, reporters cornered her and said, "Hey, Miss Gillespie, what's your problem here? You told Saddam Hussein that you have, that the United States has no interest in anything that Saddam Hussein does in relation to Kuwait. You told him this. And we have a recording," they said. Saddam Hussein had recorded her. And the lady got a fright and she ran into the hotel. And for 6 months since then, George Bush Sr. tried to persuade the world to attack Iraq with the United States, join forces and attack Iraq. It didn't work. He tried his best. And the Kuwaitis were also there in... Anyway, it's a long story. Then came along this young girl called Naira in the late teens. She said she was in Kuwait when the invasion took place, and these Iraqi soldiers came in there in the hospital. She was working in the hospital, and they came in there with their big boots and everything, and they went to the incubators, took out the babies and threw them on the cold floor. And this shocked the Americans, and he, George Bush, got the vote in the American Congress to wage war. And this whole thing of Naira was played in the U.S. Congress, and the U.S. Congress was quite shocked at what they saw, and the whole world was ready to support George Bush in attacking Iraq, except that this lady near Naira, this young girl, was not even in Kuwait at the time of the invasion. She was in America, and she was the niece of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. Even I heard that her tearful testimony to the U.S. Congress. I was very moved. I said, how can these monsters take out babies from incubators and throw them on the floor? Well, anyway, so we formed this big coalition, George Bush coalition, to wage war on Iraq. The Gulf War, it was called, if you remember. And Saddam Hussein got a skrik. But he had to save face amongst his own people. And he said, no. I will only come out of Kuwait and if you meet these 10 demands. You put 10 demands on the table. And Russia was talking to me and said, hey, bro, listen, you better leave now because the war drums are beating. And as the war drums got louder, then he cut his demands to 5. And finally he said, okay, I'm ready to withdraw. And George Bush Sr. said, no, you're a big liar. You're a liar, Saddam Hussein. And so we had the Gulf War, which started on the 19th of January. And the Gulf War was a horror story, a nightmare for the people of Iraq. Nightmare. 42 days of bombardment. Non-stop bombardment from the air. 88,000 tons of bombs were dropped. 88,000 tons. Electricity, power station, water filtration plant, dams, hospitals, bridges, factory. One factory was producing baby powder for the whole of Iraq, and that was bombed completely. This, you can't do such a thing because it goes against the Geneva Convention, which says that you cannot bomb any structure that provides help or aid or assistance to civilians. You can't bomb a baby powder factory. You can't bomb electricity power station, water filtration. Anyway, towards the end, okay, that was the first crime, right? Contravening the Geneva Convention, bombing everything. Then, crime number 2, towards the end of the war, George Bush ordered that depleted uranium bombs were to be dropped. Depleted uranium. What is depleted? It's a long story. But it's the waste product of enriching uranium for power stations, to power these nuclear power stations. And this material, leftover material, is carcinogenic. It causes cancer. 4,500 tons of this material, these bombs, were dropped on Iraq. And when one of those bombs explodes, it explodes into a fine dust, which is polluted, microscopic dust, by the way, which has polluted the air, the water, and the land of Iraq. And it's going to last for millions of years. Millions of years. And if you just breathe in one tiny speck or drink some water with this depleted uranium dust in it, you are sure to get cancer. I told you before, I went to a hospital in Basra in the south, and it was heartbreaking, heart-wrenching to the extreme. I was finished. tears were just flowing as I walked through the wards, adult ward, people suffering from cancer of the spleen and cancer of this, that and that. But walking into the children's ward was absolutely devastating for me, because as I walked with the doctor from one bed to the other, the mothers were sitting with their babies in their lap. No medicines were allowed to go in. They just, maybe you get a bottle of Panados or something like that. And these children were suffering from cancer. And the doctor was saying, and the mothers couldn't understand English, and the doctor was telling me, this child got 3 weeks to live, this child got 10 days to live, and so on. And the one image which I speak about all the time and chokes me up completely is to see this beautiful little three-year-old girl in her mother's lap, and she was looking at me. She was looking at me, and the doctor says, the cancer has spread throughout her body, and we had to remove her eye, one eye. And I can still picture the child looking at me, not knowing it's going to die very soon. Heart-wrenching. Crime number 3, Al-Amariya. Al-Amariya was a bomb shelter. When the bombing was taking place, everybody ran into this bomb shelter. America knew about this bomb shelter, that it was for civilian use. People were running in from a place called Amariya. I went there. It's a long story. I told you about this before. And America knew about this, but they sent bomber planes with one bomb that drills. It was like a drill. It drilled through the roof, very, very thick roof. It drilled through, made a massive hole, drilled through and exploded inside. But the second bomb came through that hole and exploded, and people were literally boiled, because there were huge, huge water tanks that the water boiled to, I don't know how many hundred degrees, and people were boiled to death, and many of them were killed by the explosion of the second bomb. 408 civilians were killed. Civilians, therefore, it is a war crime. You can't kill civilians. You knew it was a bomb shelter. And then, here's another crime of George Bush. Saddam Hussein says, we are going to retreat from Kuwait. And yes, they were retreating. The Iraqi army was retreating from Kuwait back into Iraq on a highway that is known as the Highway of Death. Why Highway of Death? Because tanks and buses loaded with civilians. Palestinians were working in Kuwait. Lots of I know some of the Palestinians. Who were working in Kuwait. Some managed to escape, but lots of them were in buses and trucks and everything, because Yasser Arafat supported Saddam Hussein's escapade into Kuwait. So the Palestinians knew that if the Kuwaitis regain their power, they're going to target the Palestinians. So the Palestinians crowded thousands and thousands of them into trucks and buses and vans and private cars, and were racing out on this highway of death. And then American planes, jet fighters, just came and streaked them with bombs, with missiles, killing them, burning. You go see the pictures. Just Google the word highway of death and you'll see horrific pictures. One guy was burnt like into charcoal. He was coming out of a tank, an Iraqi soldier trying to escape, and he was burnt into charcoal. The picture is there. He was just halfway out of the tank and he was burnt. Go and see the pictures, the Highway of Death. I actually went to this place, the Highway of Death, and I saw some of these burnt out tanks, and I had a guide with me, and I said, let me go and see those tanks. He said, no, sir, don't go, because it is contaminated very likely with depleted uranium. I said, okay, I'll just go run quickly and have a look and take a photograph. He said, and as I took a couple of steps, he said, oh, by the way, sir, watch out for the mines there. Also, there's a minefield, yeah. And I quickly ran back again. and you know what? Iraq has not recovered from the bombing of 1991. George Bush Senior, I declare you a war criminal. May your soul not rest in peace. May the sanctions you put in place that killed 500,000 Iraqi children, of which the other war criminal, Madeleine Albright, stated, the price was worth it. Can you imagine? Old granny, a mother, a woman, of course. saying that the death of 500 Iraqi children because of lack of food and medicine, because of sanctions, was a price that was worth it. The price was worth it. I tried to get hold of this documentary by John Pilger, Paying the Price. And you'll see everything coming to life. All the things what I told you, the hospital in Basra and so on. Everything is there. Shocking, chilling, Paying the Price by John Pilger. It's on the internet. May you, George Bush, hear the screams of these children for eternity. And of course, as we know, his lying son finished the job in 2003. The Shrub finished it when he bombed Iraq to smithereens. And of course, I was right there in Baghdad when the bombs were falling. I was right there in the middle of it all. George Bush the liar said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. It did not. He lied. It was a great crime against humanity. Bombing for no reason, death and destruction, killing civilians, war crimes. But Bush, the Shrub, gave a speech at his father's funeral and broke down crying. But the crying has not stopped in Iraq. Tears and blood soaked the land. And it continues to this day. Right, in the last few minutes, let me give you some quick news. The quick news, N-O-O-S-E. The noose is tightening around Donald Trump's neck. I just heard last night that preliminary reports yesterday by the chief prosecuting office point to Donald Trump contravening campaign fund regulations when he was standing for elections in 2016-2017. Money was coming in for his campaign, and you can't just use it anyhow. You have to account for it, use it properly. But he didn't use it properly. And this is a very serious criminal offense. Very, very serious criminal offense. You heard me? Right. And now, something else. First, the good news. The obnoxious Nimrata Randhawa, also known as Nikki Haley, also known as the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, also known as a die-hard, totally loyal defender of Israel, no matter what it does, is leaving her job in a week or two. Ah, how I hate that woman. And now for the bad news. Trump has announced that Heather Nauert is the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And who is she? She was a presenter on Fox News. She's got no political background. Trump likes Fox News. He's watching it all the time. So he brought her into the White House as a spokesperson. Now she's replacing Nikki Haley. And the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Danny Danon, said he welcomed her appointment as she is a great friend of Israel. As they say, the more things change, the more they remain the same. Well, that's all for this week, and that's all for this year. I'm off, jetting off to the Middle East next week. And I hope to meet Robert Fisk in Lebanon. What a guy. You can hear about that after the 12 o'clock news on Radio Al-Ansar. I'm heading off there right now. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.